So welcome again to Food Conversations and the initial show of Season 8. Now before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work on Shkwepakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkwepak people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing everything we can to resolve this historical injustice is a necessary responsibility for all of us. Now we're going to start off Season 8 with two guests whose connection to the world of food is through a creation that undoubtedly every listener has eaten at one time or another. Becky Dockstadter and Will Miller are the co-owners and operators of Holy Hand Pies, a thriving pie-making enterprise here in Salmon Arm. Holy Hand Pies has moved pie-making to a fine art, as well as producing a very delicious food item. Welcome, Will and Becky, to Food Conversations.
Thank you for having us here. We're very excited to be here.
We're really looking forward to it.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun, I'm quite sure. Pies are part of everybody's life, I think. Now, you two didn't begin the saga of the pie as a food item. It actually goes back a long way in human history. And Will, you did tell me how long you've been fascinated with the history of pies, so I did a little homework. Apparently, there's a 4,000-year-old recipe for chicken pie from the ancient Sumerians, who were in the Fertile Crescent many years, thousands of years ago. And the ancient Egyptians, about 3,000 years ago, also developed a version of pie in the form of a galette, an open, kind of open-faced pie. But it was the ancient Greeks in the 5th century BC who began the production of pies using real pastry, which is fat added to flour and water. And for the first time, pastry cooks, as opposed to regular bakers, were able to make a living. That's always a good sign. That's a sign that something's caught on. Of course, the Romans also took on pie again in a very serious way. But it was not until the 14th century in England that pie recipes started to really proliferate as the century. And you would know this, Will, and you'll probably add more to it as well. As the centuries rolled by, pies mostly containing meat were augmented by pies with custard and fruit ingredients, and then vegetable pies. Until in the 1800s and on into the mid-20th century, pies, although faded a little bit in popularity as women moved out of the kitchen and into the workforce. But now pies are once again popular, made and eaten everywhere on planet Earth. In fact, there was an article in the New York Times in 1902 in which it was stated, "No pie-eating people can ever be permanently vanquished." Don't ask me how that happened. The evidence for that is actually quite scant. Anyway, so thank you, Becky and Will, for coming to live here and make pies and help make the people of the Shuswap invincible, according to the New York Times, one pie at a time. Now let's start off with the name, Holy Hand Pies. Come on, Will, there's got to be a story behind this one.
Well, we were actually just thinking of a name for our company. We were in a car waiting for the ferry, I think. Our pies have a giant hole in the top of them. And so we really thought, well,
how do you make the hole? Use your thumb?
No, I mean, traditionally, that's how I started off. My first actual pies, I used to use a hot sauce bottle cap and just punch them out. We've upgraded to a small biscuit cutter that Becky's mom has donated to our company. And we manually punch holes in all the pies with a little biscuit cutter. Oh. And it makes our signature large hole in the pie for the Holy Hand Pie. But I also love alliteration, so if I can, I will use alliteration.
Now, Becky, you have a background in graphic design and marketing. This must have fitted quite well with your perception of how one ought to do things.
Oh, 100%. And that same conversation, I knew I wanted alliteration. I knew I wanted a unique name, but easy to pronounce. It all kind of just came together, I think, through many, many iterations. I think I still have a note on my phone regarding like previous names that we had thought about. But now that we're Holy Hand Pies, I can't think of what we would be otherwise.
I can't think of anything else. When I think of a pie, I think Holy Hand Pies. It's gone. Everything else is gone. Now, what was it that made Salmon Arm a place to be? Because you both come from other parts of the world, and well, in BC. What was it about? You have family here.
Yeah.
That was a factor?
I think that was one of the first things that brought us to the area. I know that my parents moved here probably around 5-6 years ago, and Will and I would come and visit. And yeah, Will and I always compare Salmonarm to a Hallmark town. Like, I just remember, yeah, walking in the downtown and, you know, like whatever time of year there's, you know, holiday decorations out, yeah. And everyone seems to be plastered with smiles on their face, holding hands, you know, little children skipping down the alleyways.
Stop, yeah. I can't. This is too much.
Maybe a bit of an exaggeration, yeah. But
they have flowers.
I think
they have lots of flowers in the spring and summer.
They do, yeah. Absolutely. I love those. Yeah, and I think that just, you know, the real beauty of the shoe shop area, combined with just with being near family, also just the general, the feel. I think walking, you know, in downtown and just making connections with strangers, and everyone's just so welcoming. And we hadn't even moved here yet. And I think that was really a draw for us to kind of come to the area.
They talk all the time about a small town feel. And I think there's something about a small community. If you've lived in urban centers, it is actually a feature in a smaller town. People just don't bother to look grim. Mm-hmm. Whereas in large city, it's like, if I smile, they'll think I'm going to give them something, or they want something or whatever.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a feature of this town that I think has already played a huge role in your lives, in your business in particular, and that's the Zest Food Hub. Now, for listeners who don't remember, the Zest Food Hub is a local food processing facility that can be rented or leased by local food producers. But what's the impact that it's had on you?
I mean, from my standpoint, I've started a few businesses in the past, and it's a huge capital investment to take a chance on an idea that might not pan out. So Zest being here, it gives you this incubator for your business that really makes the barrier to entry so small and the cost so light, where you're just paying for an hour or two to test your idea, to really launch something, to see if people really genuinely will, you know, cling on to what you're trying to do. So it's, for me, it's invaluable just for testing markets, testing ideas. Zest has been a game changer for the community. And there's 45 different users of Zest currently, and they're all making products in the shoe swap. And some of these products are now launching into the United States. They're going across the country. And so it's amazing that just Zest started a lot of these things.
Becky, the other thing is it's got all the rules in place. You don't have to, you know what you need to abide by. It's sort of already there and it's in place, and the government regulatory contacts have been made and that kind of thing. That must kind of make things take away a burden from you guys.
Yeah, I think I was very lucky coming into a food business just partnering with Will because he's so knowledgeable. But any gaps we had in our knowledge base at the time, Tracy Edwards was the manager of the Zest facility. She really walked us through. And then also just the policies that Zest has in place and all of their operating, you know, how they operate there. It really just was very clear as a food business coming in, and Interior Health loved that. So when we went to go get started, it was easy. Okay, I promised myself I wouldn't say this, but it was easy as pie to get started.
One down.
That's it.
I was looking up Humble Pie.
Mm.
And humble pie is actually a transliteration of another word, humble pie, which was pie made out of the entrails of animals, deer and other animals, and was not considered a deficit. It wasn't for the poor who couldn't afford a regular pie. It was considered a luxury pie. Did you know that one, Will?
No. I mean, I know a lot of like offal are used for different dishes that can range from the rich, like the lymph nodes, all that becomes like food that's for the rich. And then
right.
The livers are usually given away to the, you know, the poorer people. But an humble pie, I did not know that one.
Well, I had no clue about it at all. It's a strange thing because now, of course, eating humble pie means you've been embarrassed and you're humiliated and you're apologizing and all that. I'm sorry. I should never have done that. Well, life changes as yours have. Speaking of which, both of you came from other parts of British Columbia. So I thought we kind of review that a little, because everybody who comes here comes almost from all over the world and sometimes really quite astonishing distances and different things in their lives. So Becky, you were born and raised in the Lower Mainland. And in your family, when you're growing up, what was food like? You ate it, but were any special things or connections to food that have mattered to you over the years?
Yeah, I think growing up, I really just had a good relationship with food from the get-go. Both my parents were very adventurous eaters, I would say. And growing up in the Lower Mainland, we did have the benefit of being kind of in this cultural mosaic where, you know, we had a great Vietnamese restaurant just down the street. And that was my dad's favorite. He'd go get his little spicy soup or pho, you know. And or curry or Chinese food or whatever. And growing up, I think that was something that really launched my personal love of food, was just having so many options, which I know that a lot of people aren't afforded that luxury, especially if you're from a smaller town. And I think, yeah, my parents both just really valued cooking good food, good quality food, good tasting food. And I think that they really encouraged me from the get-go, from being young. You know, bless my mom's heart. She would always encourage me to cook meals, even if it didn't turn out the way that
the original plan.
Yes. And, you know, there's no containing me. I was such a creative and wild child in so many ways. And in the kitchen was no exception.
And your dad was a stay-at-home dad. He was an artist who worked out of the home.
Yeah.
And so you saw, speaking about your... Later on, we'll talk about your graphics involvement, but you were surrounded by art when you were growing up. So that's an unusual thing. First of all, the dad stays home. And second of all, he's involved in these artistic activities. How did that, having all these pictorial imagery around you, what did that do for you?
Oh, I think that was a huge part in shaping who I am and the creative person that I am today. Just not only being surrounded physically by art. I mean, like even my parents' house now, there's like rarely a square inch on the wall that's not covered by art, you know, some sort of artistic expression
or
whatever.
It's an art gallery.
Pretty much, yeah. I think that, yeah, not only did I grow up having just that physical environment, but also that encouragement from my, you know, where my mom and my dad would encourage me to cook in the kitchen and be creative with food. My dad also was always, you know, showing different art styles and, you know, encouraging me to create in whichever way as well. And as he kind of transitioned even from graphic design, he transitioned to like carpentry and like fine woodworking. And I think the creativity not only didn't stop, but expanded in different ways. And even now it's kind of nice to see my brother's got a young 1 year old and he's just, oh my gosh, his dream come true. Wooden toys are his favorite thing to make. And I like every day he's in the shop just making.
And now for the latest creation.
Yeah. So I think just being surrounded by adults who are actively pursuing their passion, I think that just is an influence that you can't undervalue.
So you started doing graphic work and advertising and things like marketing when you got out of school. That's what you sort of were doing. Sort of didn't have formal training, as I understand it, but you'd picked up so much that it was a piece of cake in some ways. Sorry, not a piece of pie.
Yeah,
I missed that one. So, but your first study, your formal study, was environmental studies. What did you study when you did environmental studies?
Yeah, I remember specifically in high school there was an event at one of the local high schools where they had all of the different local universities, so they would come and it was kind of like a recruitment night. And a lot of grade 11s, grade 12s would go, and you'd go and sit in different presentations. And I remember I sat in on a couple at the time local, so like UBC, SFU, maybe Douglas College, I can't remember, Lower Mainland ones. Mm. And I remember at the time in high school, I was always involved in so many clubs and environmental organizations and this, that, and the other thing. And I still remember going to my three presentations and still not knowing what I would do. And then one of my friends came up to me and basically like threw this pamphlet for UMBC to me and said, "Becky, I think you should go here. They're into all that same green stuff that you are." and I opened it up and that was kind of my choice. I don't know. It just something clicked. And UMBC was very pro. It, like they had a lot of really interesting environmental initiatives. So when I went there, and did my environmental studies program. It's quite a breadth of different disciplines. There's everything from different geographies to environmental planning, city planning. There's just a whole breadth of stuff that was covered. And I think that that really helped shape me as a community-minded person because, I mean, I don't have to talk to you about, you know, environment and community going hand in hand. Sure. But I think that that really, yeah, that really just kind of helped solidify who I was as a person.
And then along came Scott. You told me about Scott when we were talking before the show.
Yeah.
Scott got you on another track that was already established in your life anyway. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah. So I remember whatever, coming back from class one day, checking my email, and I had this really weird email that was like, hello, I have an interesting opportunity for you. I've seen your stuff around campus. Would you meet me in this mystery room? And I, safety sake, I told my friends where I was going, and right. I just
got your bear spray.
I am just such a curious person. I couldn't say no. I also like to think the best of people, and, off I went, you know, like Goldilocks heading into the forest. And I met with this gentleman named Scott McWalter, and he was doing at the time marketing for UMBC for ancillary services, which was all the businesses on campus. And he basically had said, hey, you know, I've seen all your work around campus. At the time, I was doing what feels like, you know, a million posters a week for, you know, this environmental club and forestry club and all these things. And he said, I saw your work and I want to hire you. And at kind of right then and there, I was taken aback, but I said, sure, absolutely. And then that would go ahead to shape the next, ooh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years of my life. Yeah. Mm.
So if you have competition, then buy them out.
Yeah.
Hire them. Now, Will, you were a native. I was trying to think what you call somebody from Prince George, a Prince Georgian. That doesn't sound right.
I mean, that's close as I can think. It was Prince Georgian, a PGN, you know. So
yeah. Anyway, but that's your hometown. And tell listeners a little bit about your parents, what they were doing, because some of it shaped you, and some of you said, no, I'm not going to do that.
My dad was always an entrepreneur. He owned the first comic book shop for Prince George. Later on, he had a store called Maison Furniture. So I think I got a lot of the entrepreneur bug from him.
Right.
But my mom was always like the cook, the chef in the family. She worked at different restaurants. She went to school for nursing, but dropped out to, you know, raise us. And when they both always worked a lot. And so I would always help prep dinner. I was always like the sous chef, I guess.
Dinner.
You know? So I just remember really falling in love with food. And I just remember no matter how hard things were in our household, we always made time for really big feasts. My mom always made sure the table was always immaculate with, you know, lots of food and options and, you know, just tasty treats. And her being Puerto Rican, a lot of the food came, it was very different than what my friends would eat. So we'd have a lot of different spices and herbs that you would normally see in tables. And I guess it's a bad word in the culinary world, but fusion. There's a lot of these English dishes my dad loved. He loved pot roast. My mom didn't know how to season a pot roast. So she would put like a lot of paprika and, you know, things like that, mix saffron rice and to go with it. But it was, yeah, I grew up loving food and food was a big focus.
What you're just describing, doesn't it make you sort of comfortable being a little more adventuresome?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I'm not really afraid to try anything. In fact, we used to play a game in kitchens I'd work at where you try and make the most disgusting combo for other chefs to try, like the weirdest texture and taste, pairing two things together. So, and that was more of a challenge to try to make something taste good. So,
yeah. I've heard of garlic ice cream. At the garlic fest around here, people have done garlic ice cream, and I've said somebody tell me that it was really delicious. They loved it.
I haven't had garlic ice cream. I used to do a black pepper Parmesan ice cream, though, for table service. It was really good.
Wow. Yeah. There we are. Now, your dad was also sort of an athletic kind of guy, and that was sort of what he... But you found out something about your dad some years later that sort of changed everything. Why don't you just share that?
My dad was the classic kind of like man's man, you know, men don't cry. He played football. You know, he was, you know, alternate for the BC Lions. He played for UBC. Like he was all about sports. And I just wasn't me. And later on, when my grandpa was much older, I was sharing my frustration, so I couldn't connect with my dad. And so my grandpa said, your dad used to write poetry in the university. To pay the bills. And so
So it was actually poetry.
He was published. So, you know, look up Garth Miller and you can, you know, that's it.
Your dad's going to kill you.
But yeah, he's written a few, some poems that were published, from university books as well as, and, Yeah, that was always been. Now I can connect with him through some of these more artistic and nerdy hobbies that he's very closed in on. He loves comic books, but he doesn't talk about it. And he doesn't. He only shares, like, you know, I love trucks. I love football. You know, that's it. That's his
we're done.
Outwardly personality. But that's I've right. My grandpa gave me the tools to chip through the wall a little bit.
Now, your first involvement with food was after you went to Scotland.
That's right. I really needed a job. I moved to Scotland right out of high school. I got a job washing dishes at a place called Jackson's Pub in Glasgow.
Now, how did you get to Scotland? It wasn't just sticking a pin in the map.
At the time, I was thought I was madly in love with this lady. She was an exchange student at her school. She went back there after school, and I said, "Well, I'll come visit you." I visited her. The relationship did not last at all, and I was too embarrassed. This is before cell phones were an everyday thing. I was too embarrassed to tell my parents I was, you know, could not afford to come home right away. So I got a job, and I moved in with some other fellow dishwashers, and I learned a little bit of cooking in Jackson's Pub.
So what was that like? I mean, how did that, you know, you'd had some exposure to interesting food experiences at home. You were working as a dishwasher, so you cleaned up after other people had eaten. What came next in food for you?
For me, I mean, I didn't start cooking again professionally until much later. I was actually went back to school at UNBC and CNC in Prince George. I was in a marketing career or trying to get into a marketing career. And I had a job at a place called Cinevate, which was a market research firm. And I thought, well, I don't need to go to school. I'm making money doing this anyways. And they immediately laid off everyone and outsourced it to the Philippines. The government put me into a career path where it's called transitions. And it still exists, I guess. But they basically pick a trade for you and they send you to school and cover your apartment rent. And they pick cooking. I'm like, that's perfect. I love to cook. I'll do this for a little bit and then I'll go back to school. I never went back to school. I love cooking from then on.
You also were linked to a very famous chef when you came down to the coast.
Yeah. My first big job in Vancouver was for Tableau Bar Bistro, working for Marc-André Choquette. And at the time, he was Canada's top chef. He's been a judge in many shows. He's done a lot of like world travel for cooking. Essentially, if you ever look up Crab Battle against Morimoto, you'll see Marc-André winning against Morimoto rolling sushi, which is just an insane thing for anyone to even attempt to, you know, try and roll sushi against the Iron Chef of sushi. But yeah, he did it and he won. So.
My goodness. And how did you get into Marc-André's good graces?
Well, in the culinary world, you do something called a stage. So you show up to the kitchen, you work for free for a day. And if you have good skills, they say, hey, come back tomorrow. You're hired. I didn't think I did the best. I'd never shucked an oyster. I'm from Prince George, so we don't get fresh oysters.
Far away from the ocean.
We don't even get clams. So I had never shucked one. Didn't own a shucker. And so I was struggling with that. After the shift, I said to the chef, hey, I can't shuck an oyster, chef. I never cooked a clam in my life, but I can break down a moose in 45 minutes. And he kind of hummed and hawed, and I think he just was impressed by the fact that I was just willing to, I will learn anything and I will do this, but I can hustle.
Yes.
And I was an apprentice next week, and I started off doing the commie work, which is prepping for breakfast and prepping for, you know, the grunt work. But anytime anyone ever said, oh, they were sick for the day or they couldn't work, I said, I'll do the job, chef. And then I had no idea what I was doing, but I go downstairs. Now I had a cell phone and I'd look up all the dishes I had to learn to cook, and I go back upstairs and faux confidence.
Oh, yes.
And
cooking. I know exactly what this is all about.
Yes. I know duck parmentier. Of course, chef. I made it hundreds of times. And and so, yeah, I just would never say no. Anytime anyone was away, I would be like, hey, I'll do that job. And I jumped into it head first, full of anxiety and panic, but just not willing to fail. So.
And how long were you there?
I mean, I was on and off there for almost 8 years.
Wow.
So, which is the longest I've worked in any single job. He had a trick that I use to this day for any of my employees, is that whenever I would get frustrated, he would kind of sense it. And he'd say, hey, I'm going to send you to San Francisco to go work with one of my friends for a little while. And off I would go. He'd just send me away for like 3 weeks to sometimes 2 months. And I go learn some new skills. And I think, oh, what a wonderful boss this was. He sent me away. It was a working holiday. I wasn't paid.
No, no.
And I come back, but refreshed with new energy, new skills. And he did this multiple times. And so I got to learn that I could travel cooking. And yeah, that was my career.
That's really interesting. And that's kind of a subtle way to say, you're getting into difficulty. Instead of saying, pull up your socks, he said, head out of town.
he was a gentler chef in that sense. He was more of the I'm disappointed kind of chef when he was unhappy with things. I worked for chefs who were the throwing the pans and the, you know, threatened to burn you and all these things. I had a friend, he worked for Marco Pierre White, and his name was Tret Jordan. And he was fired 3 times by Marco Pierre White. And every time he made sure it was like that Marco was getting drunk that night. And so he'd come back to work the next day and Marco had forgotten he had fired him. And so that was always his story. Is that, like, you know, Mark Gondry is so nice to you. When I got, you know, when I was apprentice, I was fired 3 times in like 3 months. And I had to make sure the person was very, you know, under the influence so I could come back.
The chef world, the chefing world, if you call it, has got a reputation for that. I've had people tell me that it's changing, partly because there are now women chefs. And women chefs, you know, it just doesn't seem to excite the same sort of competitive anger in a male chef when it's a female chef. Or maybe the female chef says, I'm sorry.
They don't or, put up with that stuff.
Yeah, well, good. It's about time. I mean, did you before you, the two of you got together and you started your business, had you done any paid cooking?
No, I had done paid serving for less than a year.
Yeah.
It was one of my kind of in between jobs. I think it was before I started to do graphic design. I think I had gotten a serving job, and then a week later I had this meeting with Scott, and then I said, okay, I'm going to do this instead. And then I ended up quitting, which was unfortunate because it was a great place, but yeah.
But then you did go on to teaching training and teaching music.
Yeah.
For what, 8 years? 10 years?
Seven years, yeah. I think was, yeah.
What was it about teaching music? Not everybody teaches music. Lots of people teach math and geography and stuff like that, but English, but not music. What was it about music?
Yeah, well, growing up, I always was super musical. I think, you know, looking back, you always say, oh, I appreciate my parents put me into things at the time. I remember crying on the piano stool at my teacher's house saying, I hate this, I don't want to do this. And she would just sit there patiently, and my mom would sit there patiently, and then eventually my tantrum would be finished, and I kept going. I did piano for many years and did the whole Royal Conservatory. And so when I was doing marketing at university, I've always loved music. When I got to university, just as a student, I found out, oh, hey, I can play music with other people. I'd never done that before. It was always in sort of a very formal Western setting, you know, like come and do your performance at the festival and get graded and move on to the next level, that sort of deal. And I, when I got to university, I started picking up random keyed instruments. I inherited this, this accordion from... it was a friend's family, friend's husband's passed away mother or passed away father, I think, that had this accordion in great shape. And they're like, Becky, you play instruments. Do you want it? And I was like, yes, please. And so I got into accordion. I picked up ukulele. There's a bunch of instruments that kind of fell my way.
Sounds like the two of you have the same problem. Somebody comes up with a new idea and you say, oh, sure. Why not? Let's do it. So let's talk about the business. And why don't we start with a little bit of pie talk. Ooh. Pies. Now, you started, you learned about pies in Scotland. You found out that people ate pies and they seemed to think it was a good idea. And you also, in your exploration of pie history, you got into the notion of pies in England, because that's a country where pies in every pub in the country are available. And you called them the first local food, that pies became a local food that was known in a particular community, the kind of pies they had there. Why don't you talk about that a bit? Because it's an interesting concept.
Yeah, so I've always been enjoyed the idea of like these peasant dishes and working class dishes. And we've kind of have an obsession in the culinary world right now to make them fancier than they really are and to glorify them as these like high-end dishes. But really, their roots are always in just working class people needing a meal, usually on the go, because they had to work such hard, long hours. And during that, especially during the industrial age in England, there was no one who worked harder than these people who had to go work these mining jobs. And so they had specific pastries, which is, I always say, tell people, think of the dough as like this like old-fashioned Ziploc bag. It contained all the goodness.
An edible Ziploc bag.
You know, like the old
Tim
Hortons.
Why don't they go back to that, for God's sake?
Right?
Single-use plastic. out.
Well, you know,
edible plastic.
Come to Holy Hand Pies. We have edible bags full of, you know, meat pie. But yeah, so I've always just loved that idea of like these dishes are for working class, are hearty meals. They're lower cost, and they're full of like all like the things you need. Like they have good carbohydrates, good fats, good protein. I've always enjoyed that. And so meat pies are sort of like the crowning achievement of this working class thing from like the United Kingdom. And every Commonwealth country has one. So I just feel like I really enjoy the idea of pastry and meat.
And different communities would have their own signature pie.
Oh, yeah. So like, especially the pork pie. People in Canada tend to know of the Melton Mowbray, which is the most famous pork pie with cured ham, little nitrates. It's a little, the jelly on the outside. And it's probably the most famous pork pie because it's one that took off. But there's so many pork pies out there. Mm. Wales have their own types of pork pies. There's just every city themselves seems to have their own, like their style of pork pie. Mm. One of my favorites actually, when in Glasgow, they did a red Thai curry pork pie. And it was just like, and it was one of the newer ones. It's from the 90s, but it was just red Thai curry. It was smoked chicken and pork in that same pork pie style hat shape.
So, isn't this a signature of our age that you can have in Scotland and Glasgow a red Thai, Thai, curry, Curry, you know, India, Thailand, Scotland, all blended together. I mean, the ultimate mashup.
That's it. That big Silk Road mashup of all the spices and flavors. So
it's lovely. It's lovely. So we need to talk about the Little Champion.
Little Champion.
Now, you found the Little Champion and you are the operator, which we'll talk about in a moment. But Little Champion, what's the Little Champion? Because it's a central part of your work.
So Little Champion is pretty much the integral part of our pie business. It's a device that I came across sitting on top of an old butcher shop's bathroom, I guess 10 years ago now.
In Prince George.
The Little Champion is made in Bolton, England. A small machinist part of the country, and it's basically just a large cast iron pie pressing workhorse. It's a little champion because it never seems to call in sick. It's a little, and Becky will more attest this later, it is definitely temperamental at best. I don't have to operate it, so I'm happy.
So what does it do?
So it's basically a giant heating cast iron like puck that you push down with these springs, and it's a lot of like physical power to push it down, and it melts and heats the dough into the perfect shape for these tall pies.
All at the same time.
And then you can stuff that with whatever you want, and you switch the top for a nice crimping press that cuts it off and makes that beautiful fork crimp that our pies are known for.
And the pie crusts that you make with this are not fat, fluffy, sort of soft, friable material. They are pretty firm.
Yeah, we like that. I always equate it to like the bottom of a really nice scone. They're a little flaky still, but they're not going to fall apart. We wanted a crust that was strong enough to hold all the stuff we cram into our pies. And we cram a lot into our pies.
And did that allow you to have taller pies?
Taller pies to have that structure where they can actually hold their shape. It gives us that strength and durability so you can also hold it in your hand, hence the name hand pies. These pies were meant originally to be held and walked into work. People would throw them in their pockets, go in the mine, work for 6-7 hours, take a break, pull it out, and eat these Cornish pasties, and they just be able to, you know, snack on it. It would hold up for all that, you know, that work. So
that's a pie. That's a durable pie.
That's it.
Becky, talk about the Little Champion's idiosyncrasies.
That's a lovely way to put it. So, you know, we moved down here with this Little Champion, this little pie press, and we started up this business, and I don't think I'll ever forget that first day in the kitchen trying to figure it out. It's very simple. There is, you know, whatever, 200 pounds of steel, and it's like one simple axle where the top part comes down, and you think it would just work. You would think that, but I have learned very quickly that it doesn't. There's so many little tiny, just like millimeter differences if the tin doesn't sit in correctly, or if there's a couple clasps that kind of come up, if they don't hit it just exactly, the temperature of the dough, you know, if I look at the machine in a certain way, all of a sudden we have dough flying everywhere, or it sticks to the top, or it burns, or it smushes out one side, but not the other. I don't even know. I like to think myself a patient person, but this little champion has really pushed my button.
Have you said a bad word once in a while?
Once in a while. We have a rule that we can't say that we're having a good press day. That's what we call it when all the pies seem to press out okay. We say, oh, wow, what a great press day. We can't say that until we're past the fact, and then we look back and we can say, hey, we had a good press day.
We had a good press day.
We're not allowed to say it during the time because, you know, just, of course, something will happen and the wind will blow one way and then something will go wrong.
Why do you think it's very finely constructed to have little tolerance for a little bit of movement this way or that way? Is that what it is? It's got to be lined up just exactly.
I think it's almost 100 years old. This
it's a little rickety.
Yeah,
It's a geriatric pie press.
I think it's just, it's also just us learning. It's a learning curve because the tins we have are also of the same age. We have some new ones, which we've worked with the company, which is miraculously still in business. So we're able to get replacement tins as well. So we have some new tins. We have some old tins. These tins are like sturdier than anything you've ever seen. Like, I know that Will had gifted some to some friends to like keep up some pallets of a freezer or something in their back of their farm. Like, they're sturdy. And
what exactly are the tins?
So the tin, I think,
tin cans.
Yeah. So imagine the same shape of size of our pies, mm-hmm. but imagine just a metal envelope that goes around the bottom and it has a little bit of a lip on the edge. Mm-hmm. And so that's actually what allows us to bake the pies so tall, because if you've ever seen a traditional hand-raised pork pie, if you see them, sometimes they make them with pie rings, which are like a silver, basically a tall silver ring. So you make the pie in that. The traditional ones, if you hand-raise the pork pie, so you bring the dough up around the pork ball, basically, and if you bake that without any sort of structure, you'll get this natural bowing out the side. So you can see pies that are made in the traditional hand-raised way, and you'll see a little bit of bowing. So the tins just allow us to... So we bake the pies in the tins, and then when we take them out of the oven, we take the pies out of the tins and then put the pies directly in the blast freezer. So I think it's a combination of the tins, the machine, the temperature outside. I don't know, but it just seems to always be kind of finicky. I want to say that we're at a point now where I think we kind of have it under control.
Have you had a day where all the pie crusts came out okay?
Yes. And that is what's getting me
all
through.
All right, dear listeners, for Becky's mental health, send her some good vibes. She's finally crossed this barricade.
Well, it's funny. We've actually started, there was a point where it just through natural, you know, variations where we get pies that have cracks in the side or they stick a little bit and they kind of like misshapen when we take them out. So we started a program called Good Try Pies. And maybe this is the elementary school teacher in me, but you know, these pies just get a little participation ribbon. They tried their best. They didn't quite make the front running lineup, but we sell them for half off. So if you see us at the market, we'll have our little sign up. So you can come get some not so pretty pies. They still taste delicious, but there are Good Try Pies, and you can thank Little Champion for that.
Well, and the fact that you bring them to the market, meaning that they're available for people who, you know, want to have a price break.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there you are. Now, your business is, you do your work at the Zest Thursday and Friday. So just describe, I'm just interested in the sort of flow. You know, the flow. You have flour, you have water, you have what kind of fat do you use?
Pork fat.
So you have these ingredients, and how do you, and then of course the filling. So what's the assembly line process look like? Somebody's cooking something somewhere.
We're very Henry Ford inspired, you can see. So
good old Henry.
That's it. I'm in the back basically making the fillings, but Becky and her mom are like NASCAR, like pit crews. They're just assembling the tins, making the dough, measuring things out, getting ready. So when I turn around, it's just ready for us to start filling the pies. And it's amazing watching them work because it's just in tandem. Just like you line the trays up, I fill the trays up, the trays go on the rack and roll ready for the next process.
Yes. Yeah.
We're very with our time constraint because we book the kitchen for just say 7-8 hours, whatever it is. It's a real time crunch to get the pies in the oven because a lot of our time in the afternoon is actually just spent waiting, which seems kind of interesting, but we get other work done. But it's basically, as soon as we get there, it is go, go, go. We try to get our pies in as fast as possible, because once they're baked, we have to blast freeze them. And that can take an hour, hour and a half, depending on whatever kind of variables. But, and then we package them there and we seal them up. So they're all, everything's all food safe and everything's made in the commercial kitchen. Where do you store them? So we have giant chest freezers that are the size of Will times three. They're like 25 cubic feet. We have a whole bunch of them. They're giant chest freezers. They have double lid opening. And they just, yeah, hang out in the freezer until we're ready for market day or to bring them to wholesale.
And you bring them to the market on Saturdays to the farmer's market. Most of your pies are sold by you directly, but some of your pies go to retailers in the community. If I remember correctly, it's about a third goes to, or maybe a little less, goes to other places for them to sell. How is that working out? Obviously, as people get to know your product and they have customers coming and buying them and coming and saying, I want one of those again, you know, that's always a good sign. How is that sort of expansion into the community going?
I think it's going good. We've been very slow approaching wholesalers just because we can only produce so many pies. We've picked some strategic partners like Grillers Meats. We're in the Vernon Grillers and Salmon Arm here downtown. We're also in Askew's Uptown, Askew's and Sycamus, who've been fantastic for us. Eagle Bay Mercantile is just a fantastic store. Mm. We just got into the Tappan Co-op, and then there was a... What was the farm we just got in?
Spotted Moose Farms, actually. Mm. And that just came through being at the Solista Market, just chatting with my neighbor. And he's like, hey, I have a farm stand. I want to sell your pies. And I was like, that's fantastic.
We want to give you some.
Yeah, exactly.
And I understand Ricochet has taken on your pies as well.
That's it. So if you ever want to try our pies hot and ready,
yes,
Ricochet is just the perfect place. You get a pint and a pie, which is the perfect quintessential British way to have an English-style pie.
They should have a wooden beams put mm-hmm. in on the roof of their restaurant. Now, you produce about 300 pies a
yeah,
week?
Yeah, just shy of 300 pies a week. We could push more than that, but we find that the comfortable number is that 290 to 300 pies sure. a week.
Becky, what's your vision of what you're doing in the longer term?
Yeah, I think I have been fortunate enough to just kind of take a pause and what seems like switch kind of careers for a third time, you know, from graphic design to teaching to now pie princess affectionately. And I think that one of the things I love about, I mean, there's things to love about every career and every job and every, you know, kind of path that you take. I think one of the things that I'm really enjoying now is just getting to spend so much time with the people that I love. So I work with Will, both in the kitchen, and we talk about business a lot. And then also getting to work with my mom as well. And I think that that's something that I just really value. I like the flexibility as someone who's worked in jobs before where it's, you know, 8:42 to 2:42, you know, that's the bell schedule. And it's really hard to kind of take time out, for example, to do something like this, where we get to come out during the daytime. And I think that whatever we expand to, wherever we want to grow, I think keeping that as a priority, keeping, sure. you know, family, sure. friends, right. Work-life balance priority, I think that's just so important in this day and age.
And there are a number of businesses in this community that are just like that. You know, mm-hmm. your eponymously named pie company, or a block or two away, people come to them mm-hmm. rather than them going to other people. And it keeps it more intimate. It also means that your costs are lower. You know, you're not distributing all over the countryside. The pies are not all the same. You have five different, you call them flavors. What are the ingredients in each of these five versions of your pies?
Well, our five flavors, we have our version of the chicken pie. It's not the Egyptian or Sumerian version, but it's our kind of ode to the classic chicken pot pie that a lot of Canadians come to love. And we use cider from North Yard Cider. We use chicken, potatoes, onions, carrots, a little bit of cream. And it's a really nice, rich, luxurious flavor. And of course, chive. And it's kind of the tongue twister pie. Some people come up to us and have trouble saying the name. So chicken chive cider. That's
chicken chive cider.
Yeah.
Well, I made it.
It's funny how many people will come up to us and say, yeah, I want the chicken cheddar the chicken cheddar pie. And I always say, I'm like, just so you know, there's no cheese. Just if you're expecting it.
Cheese-free cheddar yeah. pie.
That's it. We have our version of the pork pie, which is a classic Welsh style. It's got apricots. We used to put almonds in there. We've removed them. A lot of people were confused by that. But traditionally, it was apricots and pistachio in this pie. And it was a Welsh style fox hunter's pie. So we make our version of it. It has no jelly in it, though, because a lot of Canadians like hot pies. And if you heat up a jelly pie or a melt Mowbray pie, it'll melt and get very soggy. There's a layer of gelatin. So ours is gelatin-free. We have a classic Irish pepper pie recipe.
So is there meat in the pie?
Yes. It's ground pork we get from Grillers Meats.
Okay.
And then apricot, little onion, and I think there's lots of spices like mace and sage.
I am quite sure there are listeners getting hungry right now.
I always like to explain the difference, too, because a lot of Canadians, just coming from a Canadian perspective, they expect when you get a meat pie, there's going to be the meat, the veg, the gravy. And I always like to kind of set that expectation when people come to have a pork pie, because it's very different. It's almost like a giant sausage roll on the inside or like a giant pork meatball. So you're going to cut into it. Nothing's going to run. Nothing's going to move. It's just a solid hunk of ground meat in there. And I think that that's one thing that a lot of people are shocked if they're expecting one thing and, come for the other. If you've ever had an English pork pie, you know what to expect. But that's kind of education piece on our, end.
Send them all to England.
Yeah.
They'll be fine. So number three, what's the
two? So it's an Irish pepper pie recipe. And so we use ground mince. So minced beef. We have onions, carrots, celery, and a pepper gravy. And it's probably one of the most classic pies you can get from Ireland. And it's very simple, but the flavors are really deep. So you got to use really good ingredients. So we partner with Grillers Meats for the ground beef from there for that as well. And then we have...
Is that a bit hot with all the pepper?
It's got a zip for sure. I mean, some people would say it's spicy. I don't think it's spicy, but also I have a different background with spicy food. So
You had your mom.
That's right. So, but we're very good about warning people, saying if you think pepper can be hot, this is a pepper pie. So it is pepper forward.
You are formed.
You are formed. Yes. Our steak and ale, which we partner with Ricochet, which is, how we came to know them. Mark and Megan have a really good red ale. So we love that in our steak and ale pie. And we use really nice, actual steak meat that we braise over, I think it's a 3 or 4 hour cook time to really get really tender. We want this to melt in your mouth, kind of like meat. And then it's basically just carrots, onions, and then a really nice ale gravy that we actually braise the meat in for the full 3-4 hours. So that pie is I love eating it. It's the longest pie to make, and it's on my end who makes the fillings. It takes the most amount of effort, but it's delicious.
It's fascinating to see how the timing and the matching of ingredients goes. It's not, when you put almonds and apricots in a pie, it doesn't sound like the typical pie you get at the local, Safeway. That's how we say it. And then the last one?
The last one is, I think it's probably one of my new favorites. It's the harissa butter bean pie. And so we use butternut squash, we use butter beans, and then harissa, which is a North African spice blend. It's a little bit spicy. It's got some really nice smoky notes to it. And we cook it all in a really nice reduced tomato sauce. It's almost jammy with the tomato. And it's just a really nice, hearty, rich pie. And us both being people who eat predominantly a lot of vegetarian meals, we really wanted to have basically a pie that had protein and good flavors to it that wasn't just like your cursory, here's tofu in a meat pie. We wanted something different, unique, and special for all of our vegan friends out there who want a meat pie.
So you've got 5 kinds of pies, 300 of them. They're venturing out in the community and not coming back because people are eating them. One of the things you said when we were talking before was that early on, food security had been something that was sort of part of your consciousness. Obviously, Becky, you did some environmental studies, so that would bring that in. But why don't each of you kind of comment on that? Will, what does that mean to you, this notion of food security, and why is it important?
So it's important to me for a few reasons. As a chef, I really like the idea of no waste. I really strive to do the whole tail to snout kind of cooking I've always had in my entire career. But also there's concern. I grew up in a small northern community, and Prince George is a big town, but the community itself is quite small. And say if there's a disruption on the Coquihalla, we don't have food in that city.
We had exactly that same here. It was huge when the atmospheric rivers we're knocking out the highways.
Yeah, you have the current idea is that there's less than 3 days worth of food in Prince George at any one time. So that got me thinking about, like, how can I support local farmers more? So I opened up a store there that was all about buying local and selling local. And I think it's been kind of like a mission statement. And me and Becky we both agree on this very hardly. We both really believe in food security is like a very paramount to our mission statement and just how we like to live as well. We like to support our local farmers because we need them. They literally feed us.
Yeah, something that people often in large urban centers don't have a clue about. They think milk comes in cartons.
That's right.
Not from a cow.
You pick it off a tree, so.
Becky, what do you see as the essence of food security and why it's important?
I think in this past year or two, I've been provided the opportunity to become part of a food community in ways that I haven't before. I've always been people-minded. I've always been community-minded. And the fact that we're putting ourselves in these sort of situations, for example, the farmers market, working with local retailers, that it's just, yeah, I think just people are so important. When you get to these huge companies, these huge scaled operations, you do lose that sense of people, you know, you lose that sense of humanity. And I think a lot of things get, how do I say, like kind of pushed to the wayside, you know, like environment, social well-being, people's livelihoods. I think that's one thing that I am really active and vocal about when it comes to food security is the people behind the movement, the people behind what's happening. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love the shoe shop so much. Literally, you know, left, right, center, anywhere you look. The road that we drive to go home, there's farm stand after farm stand. And, you know, being part of Zest, you see all these amazing young local food producers, people who care so much about the products that they're making. And that's something that you get lost, that gets lost as soon as you, you know, scale up. And as soon as you start talking about, you know, shipping food across borders and all this stuff. And I think it is a fine balance because, you know, people are trying to make a living, people trying to support their own families and their own communities and their own environments. And I think one of the things I love about the Shoe Shop and the people who live here is that even though everyone is, you know, everyone is facing these times where it's unprecedented, just the amount of food insecurity that's happening. And even as far as like literally having food on the table. But if you talk to the people around the area who are making this food, like everyone just wants to support each other. And I think that that's really the path to where we need to go is just working with your neighbors, working with the people in your own community, because, you know, the further you go, the less connected that you are. And I think that that's something that we're so fortunate to have here is a whole whack of really community-minded, environmentally-minded, really community-forward people. And I think that that's really the core of food security for me.
In January, you're expecting to have a new human being join. You have three dogs and two adults, and now you're going to have a child.
Yes.
It's well recognized that the group in society, the demographic, as they call it, in society, that's most concerned about the future of the planet and sustainability and security in all senses is parents with young children. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's played into some of your thinking, Will, that you're going to be a father and this child will be depending on you and Becky for everything for quite some time. Does that play in there?
I mean, it definitely does. I've actually always wanted to be a dad, so I'm very excited to find such a perfect partner for myself. But I'm always concerned about the way things could go. I don't really like to think in what ifs, though. I always just try and, like, if I can look after my community as best as I can, that community will look after me. Mm-hmm. And I believe that will then circle farther and farther out, you know, like a big ripple effect. So I've always tried to live my way that way. If I can help you do something amazing, then you'll help someone else. And I'll see that back in the future.
We see on food conversations, we've had a lot of people echoing the comments you're making now that they don't want big, they want real, they want genuine, they want a sense of, you know, companionship within the community. Becky, has this changed your, I mean, has it intensified perhaps, is a better word, your feeling about how community is important, to know that there'll be a child that will be your responsibility, just the way things work out?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many historical basic principles that have been just so focused on community. You know, something as simple as it takes a village to raise a child. You know, there's a lot of indigenous ways of knowing about like the whole seven generations thing, you know, thinking forward, backwards. And I think that in a time where it is scary to bring another human into this world, I think in reality, you just have to lead by example, lead through conversation, lead through learning and teaching. And I think that that's something that I'm looking forward to, is just having those open conversations, you know, with the kid once they can speak. Yeah. And because I think that it is important to model, just like, you know, my parents modeled for me about what was important and what they valued. I think I look forward to that too, being a parent and also having them also still in my life, you know.
Becky and Will, it's been lovely having you here with us in the studio. Your comments, I think, will be appreciated by lots and lots of listeners, because it echoes thoughts that many people are starting to think about now. We're starting to realize we have to live differently. We can't just expand everything and make it, you know, big and bloated. We have to keep it small and beautiful. There was a book called that, Small is Beautiful, by E.F. Schumacher. So there we are. E.F. Schumacher, your ghost is still with us. Thank you very much for being here with us today.
It's such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having us.